From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Today we highlight a nonprofit program working to combat infant abandonment in Florida. Through partnerships with law enforcement, fire departments, EMS stations, and hospitals, a safe haven for newborns provides avenues for new parents in crisis to anonymously and safely relinquish a newborn rather than abandoning them in an unsafe place. Since its inception nearly 16 years ago, the program has saved 242 infants and helped them find adoptive families. Plus, March marks National Women's History Month. Three of this year's honorees recognized for their efforts to advance women's issues through the National Women's History Project are from Florida. We'll explore the lives, work, and impact of these extraordinary women. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. March marks National Women's History Month, and each year the National Women's History Project celebrates by recognizing women for their extraordinary work and accomplishments. This year's theme is Working to Form a More Perfect Union, Honoring Women in Public Service and Government. For the remainder of the hour, we'll highlight the three honorees this year from right here in Florida. We're speaking with Nadine Smith, Executive Director of the state's largest lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights advocacy organization, Equality Florida. Through her lobbying and activism, Smith has also co-chaired the Equality Federation and was named one of Florida's most powerful and influential women by the Florida Diversity Council in 2013. Nadine Smith, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live, and congratulations to you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me back.
And we're also speaking with fellow National Women's History Month honoree, Sonia Pressman Fuentes. The author, speaker, advocate, and attorney is a co-founder of NOW, the National Organization for Women, and was the first woman attorney in the office of the General Counsel for the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. She's also a charter member of the advocacy group Federally Employed Women, and she's author of the memoir Eat First, You Don't Know What They'll Give You, The Adventures of an Immigrant Family and Their Feminist Daughter. And her articles on women's rights and other issues have been published by newspapers, magazines, and journals throughout the U.S. and around the world. Congratulations to you, and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure to be with you.
And Florida's final 2016 National Women's History Month honoree is Betty Mae Tiger Jumper of the Seminole Tribe of Florida. She was the first woman to be elected chief of a federally recognized tribe. She created the first Seminole newspaper and the initial United East Southeastern Tribes Coalition, which today consists of more than 26 tribes. She died in 2001, but her work to preserve Seminole traditions and stories will ensure that the Seminole oral history will be available for generations to come. Joining us now to talk about her work is her son, Moses Jumper. He's just joined us on the line here. Moses Jumper, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Glad to be here. And glad to be online there.
Yes. And we also have a writer, Godwin Anino, with us. She wrote a book about Jumper for young readers called She Sang Promise, The Story of Betty Mae Jumper, which was named the Florida Book Awards Gold Winner in Children's Literature. Welcome to the show, Jan.
I feel so honored to be with this distinguished panel, especially with Moses Jumper Jr., who contributed to this book.
All right. Well, I certainly share your sentiment there, and thanks for being with us. I invite listeners to join the conversation, too. Connect with our guests. Phone lines are open at 877-428-8255. That's 1-877-GCU-TALK. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Nadine, I wanted to start with you. I know your activism began when you were in college, and this is a time when, nobody had ever heard of a gay-straight alliance in a school. Politically speaking, advocacy for LGBT rights wasn't something anybody wanted to touch. Can you take us back to the start of your work in advocacy? And did you ever envision you'd see the progress toward LGBT equality that's been made today?
No, not at all. I often tell people that the work of securing legal protections for the LGBT community really is also the work of undoing the psychological, spiritual, and sometimes physical harm that's been inflicted. I also say that I have the good fortune to have been born black, female, and gay in the Deep South, growing up in the panhandle of Florida, because it does prepare you for things. Mm. And I know in the early days, you know, I grew up in a place where there wasn't, not only were there not gay-straight alliances, but if you heard hostile things said about gay people, it was as likely to have come from a teacher as from a student.
Mm-hmm.
And the role models that I might have looked for as a young black girl, scarce as they were on television, it was even more scarce to find any character who wasn't either a criminal or the punchline of a joke.
Mm-hmm.
And so growing up in that world, just finding each other was, you know, escaping the isolation and the fear that being discovered would cost you everything.
Mm-hmm.
Was huge. So for me, activism has certainly been about the progress we've made, but it's also been about challenging some of those messages that were ingrained early on, particularly from people who really should have been protecting us. So it's been as much a legal, social, cultural journey and a personal one as well.
Sure. And, you know, do you see similarities between, you know, the fight for women's rights and LGBT rights, something of a common struggle?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, Suzanne Farr wrote a great book that I commend to anyone called Homophobia, A Weapon of Sexism, because at the end of the day, it is about challenging the idea of what is a man, what is a woman, and what are the roles that are ascribed to you based on that, you know, enforced stereotypes.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being very young, probably third grade, and I tell people that's when I had my first girlfriend, and I know she was my girlfriend because she told everyone she was, including our teacher, who she told she was going to marry me one day. And our teacher kept us during recess to explain to us that we had to marry girls to marry boys, and boys had to marry girls, which I literally took to mean at some point one would be assigned to me if I did not pick. So I went to a boy who I know what Gaydar is. I probably was using Gaydar to pick him. But I went to him and I said, listen, you and I are getting married, and you're going to change your last name to Smith, and I'll call her Amy. And Amy is going to live with us after her husband. But that was my way of sort of coping with what was, you know, this new rule that was suddenly being imposed.
Yeah, yeah.
And I usually tell it as a joke, but really it was a moment where I got the message that I was not supposed to exist, and if I did exist, I better find ways to hide. And if I didn't do it successfully, society was very happy to punish me for it.
Right. Well, we're highlighting this year's National Women's History Month nominees from Florida. You can connect with our guests with your comments and questions by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Write to us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Sonia Pressman-Fuentes, you're the daughter of Polish parents who, you know, had to flee the Holocaust, and then you grew up in the U.S., so I imagine you were certainly aware of discrimination against Jewish people, you know, which was much more prevalent at that time.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. And very early on, also against black people.
But did you draw any connections between, you know, anti-Semitism, racism against black people, and, you know, discrimination against women?
I think it's all the same. What you're doing is fighting for the rights of people
mm-hmm.
who are unjustly discriminated against because of their color or their sex or their sexual preferences or whatever. There were all struggles for human rights.
Right. And, well, you know, you, of course, have become a very prominent member in the fight for women's rights here. But is that something that you had really intended to do when you went to Cornell and then later law school?
Absolutely not. I came to the United States. I was a month short of being 6 years old. And I very early on, because my family and I used to drive to Florida for the winters, so I very early on saw the discrimination against blacks, the segregated restrooms and benches and water fountains and buses. So that became a lifelong interest of mine. But I accepted the second-class status of women, really, until I joined the EEOC in 1965. That was just the way life was, and it never occurred to me to fight against it.
Take us back to, I was going to just skip forward a year to 1966, when you and Betty Friedan and a small group of other women really laid the groundwork for what would become now.
What would you like to know?
Tell us about how it started. I was reading one account where Betty had actually just scratched some notes on a napkin, and that was kind of what started it. And then there were, you know, a group of women, everybody gave $5 to get it started. And, I mean, did you have any idea it would become?
Well, that was already beyond, further than when it started. When it started was as follows. I joined the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, the EEOC, and its mandate was to enforce and implement and interpret Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And that statute prohibited discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin. Later on, discrimination based on age and mental or physical handicap were added. But at that time, it was discrimination based on race, color, religion, sex, and national origin by covered employers, labor unions, and employment agencies. And I went there because I was interested in discrimination. But I wasn't there too long before I saw that the commission was not implementing the prohibitions against sex discrimination. There were a number of reasons for that, and I didn't really have time, I'm afraid, to go into them. But the commission, for the first year and a half, wasn't implementing the prohibition against gender discrimination. So this upset me. And I was frustrated there, and one day Betty Friedan came into the office of the General Counsel. She had published The Fan and Mystique, and she thought she was going to write a second book about all the progress she thought women had made since The Fan and Mystique was published in 1963. So she saw me there, a woman, and she came over to me and asked, said, what's going on here? What are the problems? What are the conflicts? And I didn't tell her the first time she came because I thought I might lose my job if I did. But the second time she came, I took her into my office, and with tears in my eyes, I told her that what this country needed was an organization for women to fight for the rights of women, like the NAACP fought for the rights of, at that time, they were called Negroes. And other people may have been making similar suggestions to her, and that's really, then there were other things that happened, but I don't want to take up the entire time, so what would you like me to do?
Well, let's talk about, I wanted to see if you could characterize how discrimination against women has changed over the decades.
Listen, I give an hour speech on that subject.
Well, maybe just some highlights.
It has changed way beyond. And by the way, there were 49 founders of NOW, and they included men, just one or two, but they were male founders, and there were also two strong male supporters when we founded NOW. So it wasn't just founded by women. Would you repeat your question to me again?
Characterizing how discrimination against women has changed.
When we founded NOW, which was in June and October of 1966, we did not have any idea that we would revolutionize, there's no other word for it, this country and the rest of the world. We were primarily interested in having women hired without discrimination and promoted in the workforce without discrimination and admitted into colleges and universities without discrimination. Those things were really uppermost in our minds at that time. We did not expect or understand that the changes in the workforce, in addition to educational institutions, would spill over and affect every single thing in the country.
you know, when it comes to workplace issues, do you ever get frustrated over, you know, gender discrimination issues that continue to persist? You know, for example, we live with this known reality that women earn less than men for doing the same job, but we still haven't seemed to be able to pass any federal laws to address that.
Oh, yes, we have. The Equal Pay Act of 1963, which went into effect in 1964, prohibits discrimination in pay, and so does Title VII. We haven't achieved it in reality yet.
That's maybe more what I meant. I'm sorry. Yeah.
But we're way beyond where we were.
Sure.
When this battle started in the mid-60s, women were making about 50 cents on the dollar for men. And now it's something like 78, 79 cents.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not all of that difference is discrimination. There are a lot of other factors, including that women sometimes have different kinds of jobs. But those people who have studied it have said that if you take away anything else that might be responsible for the discrimination in pay, there's a segment of it which is caused by discrimination and nothing else. And there are also additional laws that have been introduced that would supplement the laws we have already. Unfortunately, our Congress has not yet seen fit to pass those laws. But so there's more that we could do legislatively, and we just have to keep working on it.
Well, as March marks National Women's History Month, we're highlighting this year's National Women's History Month honorees from here in Florida. Connect with our guests with your comments and questions by calling 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Write to us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media, tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live, or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And now we turn our attention to the late Betty Mae Tiger Jumper. Jan Goodone-Anino is joining us as well. And I wanted to ask you first, what prompted you to write a book about the Seminole Tribe of Florida's first and so far only elected woman chief?
I met Betty Mae Tiger Jumper, and I was so fascinated with the fact that she was editing a newspaper. She was sitting at a table at a cultural festival in North Florida, and there were piles of beautiful artwork, which is only one of the many expressions of art that the Seminole and Miccosukee people are known for. But what attracted my attention were the newspapers. And I didn't know she was sitting there at first, but then a voice said to me, "You can have it." And I looked at her, and I actually recognized her face. This is kind of walking back a bit. Years before, my mother had clipped an article from the newspaper in Sarasota. This was in 1967, and Betty Mae Tiger Jumper had been elected the first woman leader of the Seminole Tribe of Florida. And my mother told me this was very important. And so fast forward years later, and I recognized her from that photograph. And that's how we began being in touch with each other. But it was many years later before I got up my nerve to ask her for permission to interpret her story, talk about her story to young readers. She wrote her own story, her wonderful memoir, A Seminole Legend, with Patsy West, and then she also wrote two other books.
All right. And a Moses Jumper, Betty Mae's son, is with us as well. We're very happy to have you. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, what it was like growing up with Betty Mae as a mother? I imagine education was something heavily valued in your home, just given how hard she had to fight just to get an education herself.
Yes, she was a very extraordinary lady. She raised us up. Of course, my father was one of the first veterans there for the Seminoles to join the military, so he fought in World War II. And when he came back, he had a had an alcoholic problem, and I guess he had, you know, go through some things in himself. But that was just another obstacle that my mother had to battle through, you know, to be the person she was. But, you know, being a young lady wanting to go to school, when she moved to the reservation here in Dania, it was a Dania reservation back then, she moved there and really to get away from the prejudice that was going on around her village there. Because, you know, she was not a full-blooded Seminole. She was a half, was called half-breeds, and so, you know, she wasn't, there was a lot of prejudice there, and there was an attempt on her life as a young girl, you know, but people around the area there, village people, the natives around the area were trying to, you know, take her life, and so her uncle in the village that she lived in told him, you know, that she was going to move away to the reservation to where they might have a little bit more protection there. Mm-hmm. And of course, trying to go to school as a young girl in the Dene area, you know, they wouldn't let her go into school because she was the only Indian there, and they didn't want her in the school at Dene. And so they said, you need to go to the school nearby, which was a black school. And she went to the black school, and they wouldn't let her in there either. So she decided that, you know, she didn't want to learn. So she decided to go to a boarding school up in Cherokee for Native Americans. It was the only one, the closest one in the southeast. So she decided to go there. She wanted to learn, became a nurse, came back to her people, worked among her people, and nursed. Of course, back in the time when she was coming through, you know, the medicines and all that thing was kind of a taboo. You know, they weren't really doing it back in that era when she came back as a nurse. So that was a big obstacle for her. And, of course, she did a lot of interpreting. You know, she spoke the three languages. And so she did a lot of that with the doctors. And so she brought a lot of the medicines back into among our people to where they accepted it. And then, of course, you know, she went on. She was very strict, you know, with me about getting an education. So there was some, you know, stories. I got one story there where she, you know, there was a bus that picked us up. We were kind of far out, and she didn't, you know, the bus couldn't make it, broke down. So I thought, well, I got the day off. Well, she said, no, you're not missing school. So we jumped in our old truck and tried to crank it up, and it broke down. So I was even happier. I said, oh, yeah, now I don't have to go to school at all. And she said, nope, you're getting to school. So she pulled out the bike, put me on the crossbar, and started pedaling me down to the school. It was about 10 or 12 miles away. I was kind of embarrassed, but thankfully a man in an old truck came by and asked us where we were going, and she told him, I'm taking my son to school. So he said, well, it's a long ways. Get in the truck. I'll take you there. So I was glad he picked us up. So that was kind of how she was pretty strict about getting that education, because that's something she did. And she was one of the first to get an education among the Seminoles here in Florida. So I've been pretty proud of her, you know, really proud of her because of the fact that, you know, that she's still getting these awards, and, you know, and I appreciate all these awards that she's still getting, especially with the one we just visited up in Washington and received that in her honor. So she was always that way with us, and you know, education had to come, and we had to have that. And she started a lot of things in the tribe, and, of course, the paper, and, you know, being the first chairman, and, you know, she broke a lot of barriers in our tribe for women. So she's still the only female woman to be the chairperson of our Seminole tribe. So I've always been very proud of the things that she accomplished and raised us up in that type of atmosphere.
Well, I read an account from Betty May herself that, you know, when she came into the chief leadership role in 1967, the tribe had just $35 on its coffers, and she said that was just ink. It wasn't even real. How was she able to financially salvage the nearly bankrupt tribe?
Well, there was a lot of the areas there that we still had land, so she through people that she knew, and, you know, some of the things that we're able to discuss with them, you know, that we had land. So she put the land on, you know, we leased out quite a bit of the land in that area, and did some other business negotiations to where she was able to, you know, to get our tribe financially stable again, because, yeah, we were really, strapped for finances at that time, and, you know, at that time period. And, of course, you know, a little bit later on, you know, we realized that, you know, we were in a tourist mecca of the United States there down in South Florida, so that it just kind of exploded from there. Of course, she's always been involved with tourism, with their, you know, their arts and crafts and things that we did, you know, selling arts and crafts, you know, at the boats. And of course, my dad wrestled alligators, and so we were always involved with tourism. So that was another reason, you know, that of course, with our James Billy now, our chairman, he grew up in the tourist area too, and she knew him. And
John, it's Sonia. I have to ask you what to do. I was supposed to leave at 1:50 because I have an appointment downtown, but I don't know what to do because you're having such an interesting conversation, but I do need to go to this appointment. Please tell me what you'd like me to do.
Oh, well, we're coming up on the end of the program, so we can let you go. But thank you so much, Sonia Pressman-Fuentes, for joining us today. Really appreciate it, and congratulations.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. And again, that is all the time we have for today's show, unfortunately. But thanks so much to all my guests. Nadine Smith is Executive Director of Equality Florida. Janet Godon-Anino is author of the book She Sang Promise, the story of Betty Mae Jumper. And Moses Jumper is an appellate court judge with the Seminole Tribe and the son of Betty Mae Tiger Jumper. Jumper, Smith, and Fuentes are all National Women's History Month honorees this year. Congratulations to you all again. And there's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers, Richard Chinqui and AJ Leonard. This is WGCU FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, and PR for Southwest Florida.